Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's my colleague, Ira Melman.
The head of emergencies at the World Health Organization said that governments that provide politically motivated information to their communities about the coronavirus pandemic could face a political backlash and called for transparency and admission of error when warranted by decision makers. Dr. Michael Ryan, speaking in general terms after being asked about conflicting messages sent by the Brazilian government over the response to COVID-19, suggested people will not be fooled.
Good governments build trust with communities by only providing them with verified, evidence-based information. Because if things go wrong, communities will understand. But if communities perceive that they're getting information that is being politically manipulated or that is being managed in a way that is distorting evidence, then unfortunately that comes back to roost. That comes back at a government politically at a later stage. I think that has been the case around the world and for many different disasters over time.
Ryan said messages about the COVID-19 situation sometimes come with political overtones and alluded to a saying that trust takes years to build but seconds to lose.
Transparency, honesty, admitting error, admitting uncertainty, in fact, highlighting uncertainties and then highlighting where certainties do exist. People can take it. People can absorb that. People are smart and people are realistic. And people aren't looking for magical answers, and they're not looking for unicorns. They understand. We all live in the real world. And in trying to present oversimplified, simplistic solutions for people is not a long-term strategy that wins with populations. So we would call for transparency, consistency, honesty, and admission of uncertainty, admission of error. And I believe that builds trust with communities. And it doesn't matter whether you're a local official, a state official, a national official, or a global official. Those same principles, I think, pertain.
The WHO Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, urged countries to learn from the current pandemic to prepare for the next one. He had this warning.
This will not be the last pandemic. History teaches us that outbreaks and pandemics are a fact of life. But when the next pandemic comes, the world must be ready, more ready than it was this time. In recent years, many countries have made enormous advances in medicine, but too many have neglected their basic public health systems, which are the foundation for responding to infectious disease outbreaks.
Tedros praised Thailand, Mongolia, Senegal, and other countries for their response to the virus. Meanwhile, on Monday, India passed Brazil as the country with the second highest number of confirmed coronavirus cases. The health ministry there reported a record 90,802 new cases, giving India a total of more than 4.2 million since the outbreak began. India also added 1,016 deaths, pushing its overall toll to 71,642. The United States leads the world with about 6.3 million confirmed cases and 189,000 deaths.
Are my pets safe from coronavirus? There's no current evidence that cats and dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
As the campaigning for the November presidential election in the United States heats up, President Donald Trump and members of his administration are forcefully denying a magazine article alleging he made disparaging remarks about military members. Critics, including his Democratic challenger in the election, Joe Biden, cite the report as an example that Trump is unfit for office. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Late last week, The Atlantic detailed unnamed accounts of President Trump making disparaging remarks about fallen military members. Elements of the story were confirmed by other news outlets. President Trump has forcefully rejected the report and on Twitter Sunday accused news outlets of working with the Democratic Party on a massive disinformation campaign. Trump's opponent in the November presidential election, former Vice President Joe Biden, said armed service members like his late son deserve an apology if the news account is true.
If these statements are true, the president should humbly apologize to every Gold Star mother and father and every Blue Star family that he's denigrated and insulted.
Biden referenced Gold and Blue Star families, members of whom either served or died in the line of duty. The president says he strongly supports the military and its members.
There is nobody that feels more strongly about our soldiers, our wounded warriors, our soldiers that died in war than I do. It's a hoax. And you'll hear more of these things, totally unrelated, as we get closer and closer to election.
On Sunday, Chuck Hagel, a Vietnam veteran and President Barack Obama's Secretary of Defense, said the allegations in the Atlantic article fit a pattern of remarks Trump has made about veterans like the late Senator John McCain.
He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero.
5.5 years.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
The history of this president over the last 3 and 4 years is pretty clear. And you can go through a litany of past things that he said from his mouth, actions that he's taken, and it corroborates, really, the Goldberg article in The Atlantic.
But Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine questions the timing of any story this close to an election.
A lot of things come out in a campaign. And I think sometimes people, when they only come out during a campaign, you know, people are somewhat skeptical about them. This is, you know, we're into the 60 days. And so I don't know what, you know, impact that's going to have.
Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Here's Ira Melman.
Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi launched her re-election bid Tuesday ahead of polls set for November, vowing victory at a scaled-down ceremony in the capital after her original plans were wiped away by a surge in coronavirus cases. Suu Kyi, who rules as state councillor, had planned to launch her campaign in the commercial capital of Yangon, but canceled the trip Monday on advice of the health ministry. Wearing a red mask decorated with a peacock, the emblem of the NLD, and a plastic face shield, she attended a flag-raising ceremony to signal the start of the campaign rally for her party and thank supporters for flying the party's red flag at their homes across the country. In an early video message to supporters, Suu Kyi asked them to follow the COVID-19 safety protocols. The election is set to serve as a test of that country's first democratic government in half a century and is seen by analysts as an important test of Myanmar's transition away from direct military rule as it grapples with crises on multiple fronts. The country had gone for weeks without local transmissions, and many restrictions had been relaxed until mid-August, when cases were detected in the western state of Rakhine. We continue on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said that with the U.S. election coming up, media companies, including Facebook, have to prepare the American people for the possibility that the results will not be known right away.
One of the things that I think we and other media need to start doing is preparing the American people that there's nothing illegitimate about this election taking additional days or even weeks to make sure that all the votes are counted. In fact, that might be important to make sure that this is a legitimate and fair election. So we're going to do a bunch of different messaging around that just to make sure that people know that that's normal. So if one of the candidates in any of the races claims victory before there's a consensus result, then we're going to add some informational context to that post directly saying that that there's no consensus result yet.
Zuckerberg said in an interview with Axios on HBO, Facebook plans to add some informational context to potential posts of candidates claiming victory before there's a consensus result. Facebook had been criticized for its role in the 2016 U.S. elections, having been slow to respond to interference campaigns on its platform then, but is now making efforts to combat that interference. Facebook began verifying the identity of ad buyers in 2018 and recently said it will restrict new political ads in the 7 days before the election. We continue on VOA Asia. The studio lights dim, the band begins to strum, and it's showtime for a Singapore Gay Thai concert, a popular form of entertainment in Southeast Asia that features songs, skits, and over-the-top costumes to celebrate the dead. Gloria Tso has more.
The lights are on, the cameras are rolling, and veteran singer Sam Liu is taking the stage to perform a lively concert for the dead. It's called Gotai, a kind of variety show popular in Southeast Asia's Chinese diaspora. It's got vibrant music, colorful skits, and elaborate costumes in honor of the Hungry Ghost Festival. On the seventh month of the Chinese lunar calendar, spirits of the dead are believed to return to wander the earth. But even with brightly dressed statues on set, this year's festivities will be a little more muted. There's no audience members to cheer on the celebrations, which usually draw in thousands of Singaporeans.
Of course I'm disappointed. Every year it's the same feeling. When the Hungry Ghost Festival comes, everyone's very happy. But this year just feels a bit empty. There's no particular atmosphere to it. There's nothing special about what costumes I prepare, what songs I'll be singing. The difference is too great compared to before.
For the past 4 years, Lex S Entertainment Productions has live-streamed the Gotai performances. But this year, hundreds of thousands have tuned in, even some from abroad. In fact, the live streams have become a lifeline for Gotai performers from all around the region. Performer Feba Huang says it's kept her in the spotlight when so many other events have been cancelled.
There were 2 or 3 months where we just didn't have any income at all, because since there were no Gotai venues, so we didn't have any income. We started selling things online to make up for a little bit of income, and now this live-streamed Gotai has started.
Gotai fans hope the shows will return to live stages soon, but for now they are doing all they can to celebrate, leaving plenty of food for the gods, paying their respects to the dead, and huddling around a screen with their friends, all to enjoy the show.
That was Reuters' Gloria Tso. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. Many robots are being developed and used these days to maximize speed so factories can efficiently make more products. One robot developed at the Georgia Institute of Technology is celebrated for how slow it is. It's called a sloth bot, and visitors can see it working at the Atlanta Botanical Garden. VOA's Elizabeth Lee is here to tell us all about it.
Hidden in the canopy behind the leaves, look closely and you'll see eyes staring back at you. This is Slothbot, a robot inspired by the famously slow animal after a trip to Costa Rica.
I got mildly obsessed with sloths. These super slow animals were just sitting there, and I could not understand how these animals could exist.
Roboticist Magnus Egerstedt realized the sloth's slow movement makes them energy efficient and almost invisible to predators. Always on the hunt to understand the natural world through robots, he and his team at Georgia Institute of Technology decided to imitate nature and created the Slothbot. At the Atlanta Botanical Garden, the solar-powered Slothbot is programmed to search for sunlight and collects data such as temperature and information on the light available to plants. Unlike a stationary camera, the Slothbot can move over a large area to make observations. This Slothbot can help with conservation and the effort to save endangered plant species, says Atlanta Botanical Gardens' Emily Coffey.
1 in every 5 plants are at risk of extinction. We have to really think creatively.
To find out about mystery pollinators for rare orchids, for example, Researchers would have to spend hours or even days watching what pollinators come to a plant.
We could put the sloth bot there instead. It can allow us to take away from that need of a human sitting there watching this for hours, the flower for hours on end, to actually allow us to be able instead to take video of that and then develop machine learning algorithms to actually quickly analyze, you know, weeks, if not months of data.
Researchers hope to one day take the robot to the forests of Ecuador or even Costa Rica, where this robot may come eye to eye with a real slow-moving sloth. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Campaigners are urging Australia to restart a refugee program that has left thousands of people stranded overseas. Australia closed its international borders in March because of the coronavirus pandemic. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Refugee Council of Australia has estimated that about 4,000 refugees with humanitarian visas allowing entry into Australia are currently stranded overseas. They're unable to travel because Australia's international border was closed to foreign nationals in March to curb the spread of COVID-19. David O'Deesh is an Iraqi refugee in Australia. His sister and her family were granted humanitarian visas in January and had planned to reunite with him in March. The family had escaped the Islamic State terror group in their home city of Mosul in northern Iraq and fled to Lebanon, where they remain. O'Deesh says his sister is struggling to survive in a small apartment in Beirut, and he is pleading with the authorities in Canberra to let the family come.
They have all the documents ready, all the approval, and unfortunately what happened, this pandemic, COVID-19, everything stops and the border closed. I hope Australian government hear our voice and change this decision.
The family has said it has applied twice for special permission from the government in Canberra to fly to Australia. The requests have been denied. Australia's international borders are expected to stay closed until 2021. Campaigners believe refugees should, like citizens and permanent residents, be allowed into the country. The Department for Home Affairs has appeared unmoved. It has said the border restrictions have been successful in slowing the spread of coronavirus in Australia. 12,700 refugees were resettled in Australia in 2018. The majority were from Iraq, with others escaping Myanmar, Syria and Afghanistan. The government has said Australia has one of the world's most generous resettlement programs and has given sanctuary to almost 900,000 refugees since the end of the Second World War. However, its detention of asylum seekers who tried to reach Australia by sea in offshore camps in the South Pacific has drawn repeated international condemnation. In response, Canberra has insisted the policies were a deterrent and have prevented migrants risking their lives crossing treacherous waters in unseaworthy vessels.
Phil Mercer is also following a coronavirus deal signed by Australia with an international drug company. That deal is raising ethical concerns among prominent church leaders.
Australia has signed a deal with the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca to produce and distribute a vaccine being developed by Britain's Oxford University, if the treatment works. But three of Australia's most senior archbishops have written to Prime Minister Scott Morrison, urging him to reconsider the agreement, saying the use of fetal tissue in the research is deeply immoral. Dr. Glenn Davis is the Anglican Archbishop of Sydney.
To use that tissue then for science is reprehensible. Once I know something that it is morally compromised, then it is my job to speak out about it.
The Oxford University study uses embryonic kidney cells harvested from a female fetus in the Netherlands in 1973. Dr. Nick Coatsworth, Australia's Deputy Chief Medical Officer, says the work adheres to strict guidelines.
There are strong ethical regulations surrounding the use of any human cell, and this is a very professional, highly powered research unit.
Other vaccines in Australia use genetic material that originally came from a human fetus. They include inoculations against rubella, hepatitis A, and rabies. Senior religious leaders have not explicitly called for a boycott of the potential Oxford University COVID-19 drug, but they have said that members of their congregations might consider their individual conscience. Experts have stressed that any successful vaccine for coronavirus developed using fetal cells would have no remnants of that genetic material in the final product. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. A powerful typhoon barreled up the already soaked Korean Peninsula Monday, toppling trees, causing small landslides, and knocking out power to thousands of South Koreans before taking aim at flood-prone North Korea. Around 17,000 South Korean homes lost electricity, and at least 48 structures were destroyed across the country as Typhoon Haishen, meaning sea god in Chinese, made landfall in the southeastern city of Ulsan and moved northward up the east coast. Television broadcasts showed flooded streets and overflowing rivers in the southern tip of South Korea. South Korean officials have not reported any deaths. However, at least four people were missing and dozens injured after the storm swept through southern Japan, according to local media. Around 300,000 Japanese homes were without power as of late Monday. North Korea is still recovering from another major typhoon last week. Ahead of this typhoon, North Korea state television broadcast live reports showing waves striking the shore bordering South Korea. The Korean Peninsula usually sees just one typhoon per year, but has been hit by three in the past 2 weeks. The situation has been made worse by a historically wet monsoon season, which ended last month. At one point this summer, South Korea saw 49 consecutive days of rain. The storms are especially dire for North Korea, which is vulnerable to flooding. The country lacks adequate infrastructure and suffers from widespread deforestation, resulting in part from people cutting down trees for fuel or firewood or to clear land for farming. Media in North Korea are not usually transparent about natural disasters or other calamities. State television usually only broadcasts prepackaged reports during a set schedule. But during recent storms, North Korean state TV has been more flexible, sometimes even airing live reports during the overnight hours. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. The United Nations warns COVID-19 possesses a critical threat to hundreds of millions of indigenous people worldwide. To mark the International Day of the World's Indigenous People, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on countries to respond to their needs and respect their cultural, social, and political rights. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
Many of the more than 476 million indigenous people around the world now live in remote locations. Their traditional way of life and distance from heavily populated areas have largely insulated them from many diseases commonly circulating. However, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres notes that throughout history, indigenous peoples have been decimated by diseases brought from elsewhere to which they had no immunity. Unfortunately, the coronavirus is following the same trajectory. The UN chief says the inequalities, stigmatization, and discrimination to which indigenous peoples are subjected are helping to spread the coronavirus through their communities. He says limited access to health care, clean water, and sanitation makes it difficult to contain the disease.
Indigenous peoples work primarily in traditional occupations and subsistence economies or in the informal sector. They have all been adversely affected by the pandemic. Indigenous women, who are often the main providers of food and nutrition for their families, have been particularly hard hit with the closure of markets for handicrafts, produce, and other goods.
The UN reports COVID-19 has infected more than 70,000 indigenous people in the Americas, the epicenter of the pandemic. Among them, it says, are nearly 23,000 members of 190 indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin. More than 1,000 have lost their lives. The Amazon and other tropical forests that are home to indigenous peoples have suffered environmental damage and economic deprivation. Guterres says these people are at the forefront in demanding environmental and climate action to protect their precious reserves.
Lapsed enforcement of environmental protections during the crisis has brought increasing encroachment on indigenous peoples' territories by illegal miners and loggers. Many indigenous people have been victims of threats and violence, and many have lost their lives in the face of such threats.
The United Nations says indigenous peoples will have a better chance of tackling the coronavirus if they can exercise their rights to self-government and self-determination. The world body is calling for universal respect and protection of their inalienable rights. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
We're back with more VOA Asia Weekend. In the final 60 days of the 2020 election campaign for the White House, former Vice President Democrat Joe Biden leads incumbent Republican President Donald Trump in opinion polling in several key battleground states, including Wisconsin, which Trump won by a narrow margin in 2016. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, organizers are working to register voters amid continuing racial unrest and the global coronavirus pandemic that has cost nearly 190,000 American lives.
It is the first week of classes at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where Evan Karabas is taking the school year, impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, in stride.
I took two online classes from my apartment. Nothing too intense.
But 60 days before the November election, Karabas finds intensity in his volunteer work with the Badger GOP, a college Republican group helping to re-elect President Donald Trump and elect other candidates on the ballot in Wisconsin.
We're getting out there as much as we possibly can, knocking doors, doing phone calls and all of that.
Opinion polling conducted in the weeks after the political party conventions shows little movement as former Vice President Joe Biden continues to lead President Trump in this key battleground state.
We're never expecting them to really be favorable to him, especially since, you know, a lot of conservative voters are afraid to even pick up the phone and honestly say who they're going to vote for.
It's going to be very close. It's really going to be about how many voters can you reach.
Rihanna Mukherjee is on the other side of the political aisle from Karabas, but as the leader of the University of Wisconsin College Democrats, is also engaged in a high-intensity Get Out the Vote campaign done virtually and by phone amid the pandemic.
People are tuned in and they'll start to pay attention once their phones are starting to buzz. Hey, are you registered to vote? Hey, did you request your ballot? Let's do it now.
I think I'm up to almost 10,000 phone calls on my app. So there's that. And then I just started doing doors not too long ago. I've only done, I think, probably less than 1,000, but I anticipate it'll be a couple thousand by the time it's all said and done.
While both Karabas and Mukherjee admit current events in Wisconsin, such as the U.S. government response to the coronavirus pandemic and unrest in the city of Kenosha, could change the outcome of opinion polling as the election draws near, it isn't changing the way they engage potential voters.
I don't think you can look at a poll and be like, okay, that's a done deal. It's really about the behind the scenes and what's happening in the country.
Yeah, I pay attention to them, but I don't let them influence my thought process too much.
I think a potential problem with the polling is the estimation of turnout.
University of Michigan professor Michael Traugott says this year is unprecedented because of the pandemic, and turnout is key, which polling should reflect.
It's probably appropriate in 2020 for pollsters to produce multiple estimates from their samples for a high turnout election and a low turnout election.
Traugott also says the race for the White House most likely won't end in 60 days as poll workers count all the ballots, including those mailed in.
It's very likely that the outcome of the 2020 presidential election won't be known for days and possibly a week or 10 days after what we think of as Election Day.
An Election Day that will be a first for both Mukherjee and Karabas. While they support different candidates and different policy positions, it is their first opportunity to cast a ballot in a general presidential election. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Madison, Wisconsin.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend. With just 2 months until Election Day, the race for the White House is not the only key decision American voters will be making. Just a handful of tight races around the country will determine if Republicans hold on to their 53-seat majority in the 100-seat U.S. Senate, a dynamic that will have far-reaching consequences for the country's political agenda over the next 2 years. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson tells us about the choices facing voters in several key states.
The Republican convention in Charlotte is now over, but the political battle in North Carolina hasn't stopped.
We're being tested as a country, but I've always run to the fight.
State Senator Cal Cunningham, one of many Democrats across the nation, running to unseat sitting Republican senators like his opponent, Tom Tillis.
I grew up with strong parents and humble people and humble places.
With its mix of rural, urban, and suburban areas, North Carolina is an ideal indicator of the nation's political mood.
North Carolina is very much a microcosm of the nation as a whole because our state is very bitterly divided. It's that last sliver of persuadable voters that could flip from one side to the other that really makes North Carolina as competitive as any place else in the country.
Polls show Cunningham leading Tillis by about 5 percentage points. President Trump is playing a key role in this race.
The national dynamics plays out here in North Carolina, particularly for the U.S. Senate race, just because Tom Tillis was so closely aligned to President Trump before COVID. But when COVID hit, he kind of started to tack more towards the middle, not really talking about Donald Trump.
The coronavirus is also a key issue in Iowa, where Republican Senator Joni Ernst,
we thought we had seen the worst,
is locked in a debate with Democratic challenger Teresa Greenfield.
We're facing a crisis like nothing we've seen before.
Over the severity of the pandemic, a sign the national dynamic will play more of a role in the Senate races this election cycle, analysts say.
We're waiting to see how folks either defend the president in his handling of the coronavirus pandemic or whether they're trying to distance themselves a little bit. And that'll depend on how much it's impacted the state.
In Maine, Susan Collins is familiar with national attention after her high-profile vote confirming Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh and acquitting Trump in the impeachment trial earlier this year.
The Postal Service is a lifeline.
She's running behind challenger Sarah Gideon, who raised millions of dollars criticizing those votes. But in Alabama, President Trump's support for Republican Tommy Tuberville,
we support Donald Trump down the line,
has been a huge boost, giving him a double-digit lead over Democrat Doug Jones, who will likely lose his seat.
And it's all going to come down to turnout, and especially in places where Trump surprisingly won in 2016. And those abilities of those senators to use their state dynamics independently from the nationalized Trump election, right? To speak to their specific states, to distance themselves when appropriate, to align themselves when appropriate.
Democrats also hope to win seats in Colorado and Arizona. They will need to pick up 3 seats if Biden wins, 4 seats if Trump wins. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The coronavirus pandemic is hitting small businesses in America especially hard. One Washington, D.C. photographer is using her camera to document their journey through the economic crisis. Maxim Moskalkov has the story.
Barbershop owner, owner of a vintage clothing store, concert organizer, and a Greek bakery owner. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, these people had to work hard to keep their businesses afloat, but the lockdown forced many had to temporarily close. But some have managed to get through the toughest times and stay in business. It's their stories that have inspired Washington, D.C.-based photographer Violeta Marcello.
Mentally, for me, to lose all your jobs and contracts and, you know, being on the phone with unemployment, I mean, these are very stressful things you're dealing with day to day. I didn't see in the media anyone covering this story. I didn't see anyone paying attention to the small business owners.
That's how Marcello's project started. Each photograph is accompanied by the story of people behind the small business and how they have survived the pandemic-fueled crisis. Eric Riggio and Angela Justice co-own an interior design business.
We're a small company. And, you know, our employees are like family to us. So we really look at this as we can't provide for our family. You know what I mean? Literally and figuratively, as everything was put on hold. So, you know, we do what every entrepreneur does. You just have to pivot and figure it out. We didn't have time to sit there and boohoo and cry or whatever.
Riggio says the crisis has taught her something useful.
So we did launch eDesign Services. We did, during this time, we're able to put our boutique online. That was great. There's a silver lining. I feel like we've done a lot. We've looked at back systems. We've looked at what we're not doing better. My business partner and I have looked at how we could, what are our roles and responsibilities, and really looked at those.
Louis Hankins, who owns a Latin American restaurant, hoped his business would finally go debt-free in 2020. The pandemic pushed back that goal, but he is still grateful.
I'm just thankful to still be here, still have my doors open, still be able to provide a space for my employees to come and earn a living and provide for their families.
Marcello says her photo stories show so much, from despair and hope to hard work and inspiration.
I want people to understand what small businesses have to go through, what they have been going through during a pandemic. It is not so easy to shut your doors and then open them again.
There were about 28,000 businesses in Washington, D.C. with 50 or fewer workers in 2019, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's about one-third of the city's workforce before the COVID-19 crisis began. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
A bitter dispute between China and the Czech Republic threatens to affect relations between Europe and Beijing. A delegation from the Czech Senate visited Taiwan this past week, which China claims as part of its territory. Strongly worded threats from Beijing against the delegation have prompted criticism from EU leaders. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the dispute comes as Europe hardens its language toward China.
Ja sem Taiwanec. Wash.
I am a Taiwanese, the words spoken in Czech and Mandarin to Taiwan's parliament by the president of the Czech Senate this week. His delegation was warmly welcomed by Taiwan's president.
Our actions are telling friends in Europe and all over the world, whether Taiwanese or Czechs, we will not succumb to oppression. We will bravely speak up, actively participate in international affairs, and contribute with our capabilities.
Beijing has reacted to the visit with fury.
We hope that the Czech side will recognize the serious damage caused by the Senate President's actions to Sino-Czech relations. Their actions will not change in the slightest the fact that Taiwan is an inalienable part of Chinese territory.
While in Europe this week, China's top diplomat Wang Yi warned that the Czech Senate president would pay a heavy price. His comments drew widespread European condemnation, note analysts.
We are seeing a Chinese government which is much more assertive, if not outright aggressive in its approach, and that is changing opinions in Europe.
The Czech population is especially sensitive to threats from a foreign power, says China analyst Filip Jeruš.
It's sort of part of the Czech historical narrative that it was always like this foreign power that was sort of dictating what we do. It was either Germany or it was Russia in the past, and now you have China.
Relations weren't always bad. In 2015, the Czech Republic welcomed Chinese President Xi Jinping to Prague with a pledge that the country would become the gateway for Chinese investment in Europe.
The economic side of things that were promised never came. And in the end, I would say lots of people below the top tier of politics sort of felt uncomfortable with what was happening here.
Opinion surveys show the Czech public has swung against China, fueled by a series of scandals, including secret payments made by the Chinese government to staff at Prague's Charles University. Europe is also hardening its language. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell described China in a recent newspaper article as a new empire that was undermining international norms.
There is a general hardening of attitudes within the EU towards China, and that hardening is primarily a response to the wolf warrior diplomacy of China, whether it is pitched against the COVID-19 crisis or because of events in Hong Kong or in Xinjiang or Tibet or the Sino-Indian borders and South China Sea.
Embroiled in a bitter trade war with the United States, analysts say China is reluctant to sour relations with Europe. But Taiwanese independence touches the rawest of nerves in Beijing, and there could yet be further fallout from the visit by the Czech delegation. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. India, one of the largest COVID-19 epicenters, is adding new cases at the world's fastest rate. Even as it approaches the 4 million mark, authorities are opening the economy as they focus on mitigating the devastating impact of the pandemic on millions of people. Anjana Pasricha visited a weekly market in the Indian capital that has allowed cities' pavement markets to reopen.
Hawking items like belts, utensils, and clothes, these vendors are impatient to resume business at this weekly street market after 5 months. However, the pre-pandemic crowds of bargain hunters are missing.
I used to make about $2 to $5 daily. I have not even sold a single item so far. For 2 hours, I have not seen a customer.
These vendors carry their wares to pavement markets held across the city. But shoppers are wary as cases of coronavirus surge in Delhi.
It does not seem anyone will come. By this time earlier, there used to be a huge rush. Now there is nobody.
The pandemic is raging in India. It recorded 2 million infections in August, the world's highest. However, cities such as Delhi are lifting restrictions swiftly to restore lost livelihoods amid mounting concerns about long-term health risks due to the devastating loss of incomes.
There are huge consequences, storms of nutrition among children. Immunization services are disrupted. And these things are likely to have impact down the line, 2-3 years down the line, or maybe even longer.
The government has been giving free cereals and lentils to poor people. It helped, but with incomes gone, it was not enough for many.
It was difficult to buy vegetables and milk. I hope I can buy these for my children now.
The struggle to buy enough food is uppermost in the mind of Mohammed Shehzan, whose family had to cut back on portions.
I'm scared of contracting coronavirus, but I must work to survive, because even if the virus doesn't catch us, we could die of hunger.
Authorities are taking precautions. This van stands ready to conduct tests. Stalls are set at a distance. Repeated announcements emphasize safety.
We have put sanitizing machines. All stalls have sanitizer, and we give masks to whoever doesn't have one.
But hope is turning to despondency. After setting up this stall, Hari Gobind Singh planned to recall his extended family, who left for the village when he had no income. Now, he is not so sure.
I'm not sure if this work can continue. We made good money earlier and could run our households easily. Two of us support 20. But only I know now how we are coping now.
The economic scars of the pandemic will not disappear anytime soon, despite reopening cities on which many depend for their livelihoods. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, President Donald Trump created controversy last week by appearing to urge his supporters to vote twice, through the mail and in person, to test the election system and ensure that their votes count. Voting more than once is illegal, and the president's comments have been slammed by critics, including Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Sawara has the story from Biden's home state of Delaware.
Trump supporters were energized during a rally in Wilmington, North Carolina, where President Donald Trump appeared to make a controversial suggestion to vote by mail and then go to a polling station and possibly vote again.
And if on election day or early voting that is not tabulated and counted, you go vote. And then if for some reason after that, it shouldn't take that long, it comes in, they're not going to be able to tabulate it because you will have voted. But you have to make sure your vote counts.
Trump, who has previously said voting by mail leads to voter fraud, reiterated his message via a series of tweets, which Twitter has labeled as violating its civic integrity policy for encouraging people to potentially vote twice. Voting more than once is illegal in the U.S. Most states are encouraging voting by mail as a safe and secure method during the pandemic. Trump's remark was condemned by critics, including Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, who accused Trump of undermining the American election system.
I think it's all designed to create so much chaos that no matter what the outcome of the election is, that it's thrown up in the air. I mean, that must be his reason because, I mean, he says and does things that no other president that I'm aware of in American history has ever done. And we all go, well, there's another ridiculous, illegal, inappropriate thing he said.
White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany defended Trump's statement.
The president wants enfranchisement, not disenfranchisement. That's his goal with the comments that he made.
But election officials and analysts are concerned about the potential impact on polling stations.
I think what the president and what the press secretary are missing is the chaos that a significant number of people who have already cast their absentee ballots showing up at the polling place will mean, because the polling places themselves are not set up to handle, you know, a significant influx of provisional ballots. What it yields is a longer process for check-in, which means longer lines, and those individuals aren't going to get the information they wanted anyway.
Facebook said it would take down posts containing video of Trump's remarks on voting twice unless the posts correct the record about voter fraud. Patsy Whitaker-Sawara, VOA News.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. About 20 U.S. professional basketball teams will be converting their venues into pandemic-safe voting centers for the 2020 presidential election. The move is part of a deal with the NBA players, who briefly halted their participation in the season-ending playoffs to protest racial injustice and police brutality. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports the latest arena to announce its plans is New York City's Barclays Center, home to the Brooklyn Nets.
Officials with the Barclays Center this week encouraged residents to come to the arena to cast their ballots in the November general election.
We think it's very important, particularly during this pandemic, to provide the residents of this city with as many safe and open voting centers as possible. And so we were happy to work with government officials to make that happen.
City officials who appeared with Abamandi called for more owners and cities to offer their spacious arenas as sites where people can safely vote while observing social distancing recommendations. In late May, demonstrators gathered outside the Barclays Center Arena to protest the death of George Floyd in the custody of Minneapolis police.
It is crucial that all of our arenas throughout the country join the Barclay, join Madison Square Garden, and join other venues to say we will open our doors and ensure that people will be allowed to vote. This space is being transformed from a place where peaceful protests took place to a place where peaceful voting will continue.
The initiative was part of a deal negotiated with the players to end a boycott that shut down the NBA playoffs last week. The boycott spread quickly after the Milwaukee Bucks refused to take the court against the Orlando Magic in response to Jacob Blake's shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Over the last few days in our home state of Wisconsin, we've seen the horrendous video of Jacob Blake being shot in the back 7 times by a police officer in Kenosha and the additional shooting of protesters. Despite the overwhelming plea for change, there has been no action. So our focus today cannot be on basketball.
The unprecedented sport boycott in support of racial justice spread rapidly, shutting down almost all professional sports in America for several days. Several team owners supported their players, but not everyone was pleased. President Donald Trump tweeted, "People are tired of watching the highly political NBA. Basketball ratings are way down and they won't be coming back." In response to Trump's tweet, Milwaukee Bucks Kyle Korver said, "Life is not about ratings. Life is about standing for what is right." Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden expressed support for the Bucks players, saying in a tweet, "This moment demands moral leadership, and these players answered by standing up, speaking out, and using their platform for good." The season resumed after players, coaches, and league officials agreed on concrete action to promote voting and civic engagement and support police and criminal justice reform legislation. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, about one-third of the New York City's 240,000 small businesses may never reopen after the coronavirus pandemic is over. That's according to a report by the business group Partnership for New York City. Among them are small businesses owned by women. Nina Vishneva spoke with female entrepreneurs about their efforts to survive in this report narrated by Anna Rice.
Maya Aquaviva hasn't been here since her restaurant was forced to close in March due to the pandemic. For over 7 years, this has been like a second home to her.
My grandmother used to call her home Oda Sakhli. Oda House, a wooden house in the mountains.
People would come here in search of just that, the feel and taste of home. Oda House was the first restaurant in Manhattan to introduce New Yorkers to Georgian cuisine.
No one believed a Georgian restaurant would be a success. People don't know where Georgia is, and you think your khachapuri, chakapuli, and hinkali will sell?
The restaurant had survived many challenges, but the pandemic proved to be too tough to handle. Though the landlord gave Aquaviva a rent discount, working only for takeout wasn't enough. Oda House had to close, like many other restaurants in the area.
On this block alone, there are 8 vacant spaces. Who would want to go into restaurant business these days?
Oda House is not alone. About 3,000 small family-owned businesses reportedly have been forced to close since March, when New York City shut down because of the pandemic. Small business owners hoped they would survive the financial blow. Despite relief from a federal stimulus package, many did not survive. According to New York labor figures, small businesses employ more than 3 million people, about half of the city's workforce.
Old MacDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O.
Bank Street, the oldest children's bookstore in New York City, shut down due to the pandemic.
We've always been the place where kids could come after school and sit and do their homework, where toddlers could come on a Saturday morning and sit all together on the floor mats and listen to a story, where classes could come in and with their teachers and learn about what a bookstore is and why books are important.
For several generations of New Yorkers, this was a favorite go-to bookstore. All these years, the business has been managed by women. Store managers say employees could no longer engage young readers to sell children's books.
Now we're finding that customers who are ordering books from us to be shipped are saying, we don't live in the city, we left in the beginning of this, and we're not coming back.
Lalita Kamut hopes she won't have to leave. After 3 decades selling perfume in her Manhattan store, she says demand has dropped since the pandemic began.
What happened is, you know, the sale is really went down 90%. And so far, no one coming in. It's only like maybe one person a day, and sometimes nobody.
Kamut says without help from the city, her store probably won't make it. Meanwhile, she's hoping a safe and reliable vaccine will come in time to save New Yorkers and businesses like hers. Fanina Vishnyova in New York, NRI's VOA News.
With the end of the summer season in the United States, it's a time when many families are preparing for the new school year. But with the threat of COVID-19 delaying a return to campuses across the country, preparations this year include trying to make online learning work better for everyone. Matt Dibble has the story.
It's a new school year in the U.S., where the pandemic has closed many campuses and forced classes to continue online. At Oakland Technical High School in Oakland, California, students line up for books, and for some, computer equipment, like laptops, to use at home.
We have one at home. It's just really hard because we're splitting it between 3 of us.
The Oakland School District estimates that half of its roughly 50,000 students lack the technology they need for remote learning, a crisis affecting schools across the country.
So this is Chromebook, the charger.
Nonprofit groups have joined forces with Oakland schools to bridge a digital divide that has persisted for decades.
Yeah, sometimes the internet does go a little slow because we're all on the computers.
The coalition is raising funds for equipment, such as laptops, internet service, and tech support for every student in need.
I think the internet connections to the world through the internet are almost as important as food in this day and age. The pandemic forced us to rethink how we do things and get it right.
This mother has 5 children studying at home.
I went to the schools and collected the Chromebook for every child.
When nearby Emerson Elementary closed its classrooms in March, second grade teacher Peter LaMotta worried about losing contact with his students.
Oh, it's so good to see so many names and kids. I miss you guys.
He launched Storytime with Mr. LaMotta on Facebook Live, a platform he hoped more families would be able to access using cell phones. As the new school year begins, LaMotta fears that some students who have not turned up are still lacking what they need to connect.
It's the difference between you having school and you not, or the quality of school that you have. Because you have sometimes students come in where they might not participate in a conversation, because every time they turn on their video or just even to try and speak, there's it glitches because it's not strong enough.
It's hard to believe that in the U.S., about 1 in 5 kids are struggling with either lack of access to a device or to Wi-Fi. We know from surveys of teachers around the country, they're very concerned about the learning loss their kids have already had. And now they're staring down another year of this.
So here is the hotspot.
And so the scramble to give out technology, adding new urgency to closing a digital divide. For VOA News, Matt Dibble, Oakland, California.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.